available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. Fight! I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner going to try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome, everybody, back to the Podcast of Champions, recapping the final Pac-12 bowl games. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site of the Scout.com network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the Scout.com network. And we are the Podcast of Champions, bringing you the final three bowl games, David, that didn't go quite as well as we thought they were going to go. Not the greatest finish for the Pac-12 after the new year. 2015, pretty good. 2016, not so good.
Yeah, and not so good for my picks either. I think I got two of these wrong, and one of them I think we just tied on.
Yeah.
So that's not good, especially given how well we started. This was a pretty poor finish.
Yeah, I think the only one we got different was Stanford. I had Stanford, you had Iowa. So I got that one right.
That looks pretty stupid right now.
Yeah, that
that doesn't look all that smart.
That wasn't the greatest pick in the world from you. But I think no. I finished 6-2-2. It was pretty good. And then you finished 5-3-2. I believe that's what the final standings were.
Hey, I'll take that.
Both winning records.
Oh, yeah.
Not too bad. This show, we're going to do a recap of the last three games, and then we got some questions to get to. One of the questions that were brought up last week, the best and worst moments for all of the Pac-12 teams. So we got some of the scout experts to send us in their thoughts, and David and I will share our thoughts on USC, UCLA, and any teams that we had left out. And want to let people know, if you want to send a question into the show, the email address, the best thing, pac12podcast@gmail.com. You can also tweet us. We've been active on the Twitters, at pac12podcast. Our website, where we put up all the episodes, is pac12podcast.com, so it's a common theme there. And then the voicemails, which we love, 641-715-3900, then it's extension 734-972. Of course, you can go to iTunes and subscribe there. We'd love that. So lots of different ways to get a hold of us here on the Pac-12 Podcast.
Yeah, tons of different ways. We love to hear from all of you. More voicemails. I'm not going to threaten you this time, but more voicemails. We want to hear from you. And, you know, some of the screenplay pitches have been a little curtailed for time, but we're getting into the off season now. I mean, we could listen to a 5-minute voicemail. There's no telling what we'll do in the off season.
We definitely could, Dave. I don't know if we want to encourage
that. I don't know if we will. I don't know if we're really encouraging it, but we're not. I don't want to say we're discouraging it.
Yeah.
All right.
So get on that voicemail line and give us a call.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, I think we should
go wherever it takes. You know, if it's 10 seconds, great. If it's, you know, a minute, that's fine.
Yeah.
Maybe don't five.
We should probably jump right in. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I guess so. Let's do it.
We'll do a little work here. That's why we're here. We're going to do our
Pac-12 Roundup.
Nice little sound effect there for the Pac-12. And the first game, which, like we said before, Dave did not get right. I got this one right. It was the
Stanford Cardinal
and Iowa Hawkeyes in the Rose Bowl. So, what'd you think, Dave?
I was not right very early in this game. Stanford ran out to a 35-0 lead at halftime.
Is that good?
And I think that's pretty good. I think that's pretty good. And I do mean ran out to it, because Christian McCaffrey was the big story of this game. I think he had approximately 1,000 yards in this one. He was just phenomenal. Iowa, I mean, it was just a different – it was like, you know, a really good, like, JV high school team went up against, like, you know, St. John Bosco or LSL. It was just like, yeah, this isn't really fair in any real way. You know, Stanford – you don't think of Stanford as being, like, outclassing other teams in terms of athleticism, but you could – it was noticeable on the field. I mean, just a different kind of class of athlete just ran all over Iowa. Christian McCaffrey, insane day. Only 18 carries for 172 yards. Fool almost averaged 10 yards a carry.
Wow.
And that wasn't even the most impressive thing he did today. He had four catches for 105 yards, had a punt return for a touchdown. I mean, he was just nuts in this game. He pretty much single-handedly beat Iowa. And, yeah, I mean, Kevin Hogan went out on a good note, but they crushed the life out of Iowa, and they go into they're clearly the standard bearer of the conference right now, the Stanford Cardinal.
Yeah, I think when we saw that game, it kind of felt good. And we'll talk about the other two Pac-12 games, Oregon and Arizona State, but you kind of felt good, like, yeah, this is going to be a pretty good year for the Pac-12. Even though the LA schools kind of dropped the ball, Pac-12's going to finish strong. Obviously, it didn't happen, but it was kind of one of those things. The first play of the game, sometimes you get like a big special teams play, like the underdog team returns a kick for a touchdown. They got all this excitement, and then the other team just kind of bowls them over. It wasn't anything like that. It was just the team that was supposed to bowl them over did. 75-yard bomb to Christian McCaffrey. So they scored in 11 seconds, fastest TD in Rose Bowl history, and it just kind of got worse from there. I think it was 21-0, like 11 minutes in, and they had a pick six. And McCaffrey, like you said, went absolutely bananas. No one's ever had 100 yards receiving and 100 yards rushing in a Rose Bowl. He did that. The all-purpose yardage record he broke, 368 yards. And I guess the most important thing was after the game, everyone was talking about, yeah, he probably should have won the Heisman. So
yeah.
Larry Scott's probably scratching his head like, maybe if we put Stanford on during the day a little bit more, this wouldn't have happened.
Or maybe if we, actually campaigned for him, if Stanford had maybe, had a little bit more cohesion to their Heisman campaign. I don't think it started until like the eighth or ninth game of the year. The Pac-12 should have been pushing it a long time before that. I mean, this should have been a narrative that built rather than just, entering November. Oh, yeah, there's Christian McCaffrey. It should have been something where he was talked about all year in context of the all-purpose record, the whole thing. And really educate people on why what he's doing is so impressive, because, it crystallized in that final game, I think, of the regular season, where somebody said, yeah, okay, he broke Barry Sanders' record, but he did it in fewer touches, which is probably the most impressive thing, because people talk about, oh, it's more games, but it was fewer touches.
Yeah.
So all of that, very, very impressive. I think maybe one of the bigger takeaways from this one is Stanford, I think, really finally figured out its defense in this one. Iowa had a pretty good running game, a pretty good offense going into this one. I mean, it wasn't great by any stretch of the imagination. It was a Big Ten offense, but it was decent enough. And Stanford completely shut them down. Iowa only ran for 48 yards on 38 carries. So Iowa was clearly trying to, establish the run, and Stanford wasn't having any of it. Stanford loses a little bit on defense next year, but I think by the end of the year, they were kind of figuring out what they needed to do defensively, and that's a really good sign for that coaching staff going forward, and I think for the general stability of that program. I don't think there's a program on stronger footing right now than Stanford. Year in and year out, their down years are 8-win years, and that's such an impressive turnaround for Stanford from where it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, David Shaw, you got to give him a ton of credit. Look, I mean, we both thought, well, at least I did. I don't remember if you did. I mean, that they were going to take a step back. They didn't look good early in the season.
I had him at 10-2. I had him at 10-2.
Okay, so you did. I mean, I picked Oregon to win the North, but I really felt Stanford was not going to be the same. All the guys had to replace on defense, but I mean, once he got it going, you still scratch your head early in the season, like how they scored 6 points against a not that great Northwestern team. But he got it going, and that's the class of the Pac-12 right now. So I think they're going to have to, be the favorites again next year, even. With Kevin Hogan being gone and some of the guys they'll lose on defense. But I think they're still going to have to be the favorite next year.
Yeah, I don't think you can point to another team that has their just stability, their continuity year in and year out. They build up through the lines, which is the way you're supposed to build a team. And I've got confidence in, if it's Keller Christ and he comes in there and, he has to manage games more. Kevin Hogan wasn't some spectacular guy making crazy plays all the time. He just kind of managed games, and I think Keller Christ is more than capable of that. He was a very heralded prospect out of high school, so I think they definitely have the best framework for consistent championship contending teams year in and year out. And you know, right now, looking at, you know, every team in college football, I think, you know, if this was an 8-team playoff, I don't think anybody would be wanting to play Stanford right now. I think they would be ecstatic to keep playing right now, the way they're playing at this stage.
Yeah, and a lot of talk about, hey, you should have 8 teams because you want a team like Stanford in there. Finished 12-2, 9-1 overall in the conference. So nice job from David Shaw and Stanford. Then it kind of went downhill, Dave, after that.
Yeah, it kind of did.
So that was January 1st, traditional. Then we have the not quite as traditional January 2nd bowl.
Oregon Ducks.
Taking on TCU in the Alamo Bowl. Again, this was January 2nd.
Yeah, this was like the perfect encapsulation of Oregon's season. I thought, like, if you were a little confused watching the end of the year and like, how did Oregon lose 3 games? This game provided you the answer. When Vernon Adams goes down, Oregon is not just pedestrian, but actively a little bit putrid.
Yeah.
Vernon Adams in the first half leads them to 31-0 at halftime. Everyone's romping and roaring. Oregon's going to win. They're going to go into the offseason on a high note. We're going to look at Oregon and Stanford again next year. And then Vernon Adams goes down. Jeff Lockey comes in, and they don't score another point in regulation, allowing TCU to tie it up. And then TCU takes control in overtime, wins it by 6, 47-41. I mean, that's really the only story from this game. I mean, you know, their defense wasn't good again in the second half, but for the first half, they mostly stymied TCU. And yeah, TCU was out without Trevon Boykin, who, as we talked about last week, punched a cop. But, you know, this was still, I think it was, you know, it was still kind of just the story of the season. Their defense faltered when it mattered the most. And without Vernon Adams, their offense isn't very good. And I think, you know, they made some changes just in the last week. I think Don Pelham is moving down to linebackers coach. So they're in the market for a new DC, which I think is a good move for them. But life without Vernon Adams, I don't know if this other FCS transfer that's coming in is going to be as good. But life without Vernon Adams, coming off the heels of life without Marcus Mariota, could be a rough one for Oregon.
Yeah, it was. I mean, when you're going to recap this game, if you had to use the words Jeff Lockey at some point, it probably wasn't going to be a good thing for Oregon. But to have that big of a drop-off, and there was some, you know, you saw some stuff on Twitter. There was this guy who's like some handicapper in Vegas that was like, you know, sending Jeff Lockey tweets that he should die and all this stuff. Just awful, awful stuff. But I think people seriously were counting their winnings. And I was like, oh, good, we won this, you know, I won the Stanford game as far as the picks. Oh, I won the Oregon game. This is pretty cool. And, like, then you start seeing the second half. You're like, wait, is the spread going to – are they going to beat the spread? And then, like, are they going to lose this game? And they did. And it just kept getting worse and worse. And I think that this Oregon defense, though, needs the offense to score. It's not really about time of possession. I just think they need some of the momentum you get when Oregon's able to blitzkrieg the other team and put some points up. And when that goes away – and they're going 3-and-out, and they're going backwards and not doing anything, it just seems to take something out of that Oregon defense. You know, they can score in a minute and a half or a minute or whatever, or they give the ball up in a minute and a half. It just seems to make a difference when you get those extra points on the board. It's a little bit of boost to the defense. But when you're not scoring and you're giving the ball away that quickly, the defense just looked absolutely awful. I mean, this was a hot garbage, maybe the worst half of football like you ever want to see. And the fact that they were up 31-0 when they did that is just, you're scratching your head like, how is that even possible?
Yeah, because you'd like to think that your system is strong enough to, you know, score points even if you've got a backup in there. I think Oregon's system is, and I don't want to, like, belabor the point because he's just doing his best, but I just think Jeff Lockey is that significant of a drop-off from Vernon Adams or from really any, you know, I don't want to say any Division I quality quarterback. But he's a backup for a reason, and he's probably not a guy you want to even go into your season with as your second string guy. You preferably have him as your third string or even your scout team quarterback. But you know, through circumstances of recruiting and all those sorts of issues, they wanted a redshirt Travis Johnson this year. Through all those reasons, he ended up, you know, the second string guy. And he's just not capable of you know, playing at that level. And he's not quite capable of executing really much of that offense at all. He's not much of a runner, and he can't really throw downfield. So it kind of turns into a West Coast offense, and they don't have the complexity in their offense to do that. I mean, it can't just be a short passing scheme. That's not what their offense is. And he kind of, you know, makes it very, very one dimensional. And that really hurts Oregon because they're built so much on speed and so much on, you know, being able to do a lot of different things that he's just not capable of doing. But, you know, good on TCU winning a game with their backup quarterback, obviously a more talented backup than Oregon has. But I don't think this necessarily reflects too much on Oregon, except what we already knew. Their quarterback depth chart sucks, and yeah, they need to keep going to the FCS, you know, well, until they figure out some depth things. You've got, you know, Travis Johnson there, who they're expecting to be their quarterback of the future, but he's probably not ready next year. And then they've got Ryan Kelly coming in 2017, but, you know, they've really got to build some depth through high school recruiting, because this, you know, going to an FCS guy every year, that's a gamble that's probably not going to pay off eventually.
And then the one thing, Dave, where, okay, you get that Vernon Adams is gone, that he was out of the game. His career is over at Oregon. And Jeff Locke, you're trying to let him do something and get the offense going. Basically, if you score a single point in the second half, you win the game. Royce Freeman was still running really well, and they would get away from him for long stretches and have Jeff Locke throwing balls out of bounds. It was just, it was weird the way that offense was going, knowing that Locke wasn't really getting it done. If you just handed the ball off to Freeman three straight times, not only are you running clock, but at least, I mean, you got a chance at making first downs and scoring again. And for some reason, they weren't doing that.
It almost looked like they didn't even have a contingency plan built for the case where Jeff Locke has to play. And you would think after going through a good portion of the season where Jeff Locke had to play, that they would have had a better plan in place at this point of the season for, you know, this eventuality. And they just didn't. I mean, it looked like they were just kind of, you know, they didn't really have any sort of offensive plan. And, you know, that's just kind of a worry for Oregon from a coaching staff standpoint. But, yeah, I mean, not that significant, but they definitely need to figure out their quarterback situation.
All right. This was the next one is the last bowl game of the whole bowl season, which I didn't realize that. Sometimes they were having ones before, like on the 4th and weird, you know. So apparently that's all done. So this one is the Cactus Bowl, the Motel 6 Cactus Bowl between
Arizona State Sun Devils
and West Virginia out in the desert.
Yeah, this was a really fun game. You know, I think we talked about before bowl season, we thought the UCLA-Nebraska game was going to be fun, but I think this one was probably, in terms of, you know, going back and forth, the whole thing, I thought this game was a lot of fun. Hinged on a really, really kind of boneheaded thing from the ASU coaching staff where they didn't go for two on their final touchdown,
yeah.
And they went up 6 instead of 7, and then West Virginia promptly came back down the field and scored, and that one point proved to be the difference between a tie and overtime and a defeat. Do you have any idea why they did that? Do you think it was just a complete just mental error, or do you think they had some sort of strategy for why they were not doing that?
No, I don't think there was any strategy there. I didn't look at the whole Todd Graham, you know, press conference and stuff afterwards, but he brought it up, and it seemed like it was some sort of error where, like, yeah, we have a chart, and you definitely should have gone for two at that point. And yeah, that's a huge gaffe. I mean, that's a difference between losing the game and trying to win it in overtime. And you know, they were the benefit earlier in the game of some weird extra point play, because West Virginia was they had a lot of explosive plays in this game. I mean, they big chunks they were getting on this Arizona State defense, and late in the first half they score and they're up 22-13, and then Arizona State blocks the extra point, returns it for two, and then they tried like this weird squib, like onside kick thing that doesn't work. And then Arizona State, you know, gets it and kicks a field goal. So it was like, it should have been 23-13 going into the half and ends up being 22-18. It was like much closer. So I think Arizona State benefited early on, but late, I mean, those 2 points really counted, obviously, but they would have had a chance to go for two and at least, you know, put yourself in position to be up 7 instead of 6. And that's just I think to me, it's just a Todd Graham error, Dave.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked about this all year, too, the Arizona State offense. And it worked out in this game, but still, you've got DeMario Richard and Kalen Ballage. They ran the ball 32 times in this, which includes 4 Mike Bercovici runs, and probably 2 or 3 of those were sacks. And they threw the ball 52 times. And Bercovici had a nice game, but I don't know why they're not running the ball a little bit more. I mean, I get it from a West Virginia perspective. I mean, I think they're kind of oriented around a passing attack much more, but I think it's, and this is just a, you know, a season-long story, but I think they should have been running the ball more all year. Devin Lucien had a huge game in this one. 9 catches for 144 yards. He actually went over 1,000 yards this season.
Wow.
And I'm pretty sure his UCLA season high ever was like 200. So really, really good season for Devin Lucien. I think he kind of answered, especially over the back half of the season, he answered that ASU question as to who's going to be the go-to receiver in the absence of Jalen Strong. It took till midseason, but I think Lucien answered that pretty emphatically. Yeah, this was just, I mean, it was a fun back and forth game. It was a lot of fun to watch. But I think it's, you know, ASU's issues, that Todd Graham defense, you know, it's the common, you know, saying about it is it's either boom or bust. You know, you're either getting a big, you know, big play from your defense or you're giving up a big play. I think it really, really went more towards giving up big plays as teams have had time to scout it out. I think he really needs to either dial back the aggressiveness or build in some more variation, because I think teams have really got that defense scouted now and are able to gash it pretty hard.
They did. It was getting gashed all night. I mean, it started early with, you know, West Virginia and just kept going. And at the end of the day, would you have thought Arizona State finishes with a losing record, finishes 6-7? I mean, that's absolutely crazy. A lot of people picked them to win the Pac-12 South.
They were our unanimous number 2 in the Pac-12 South.
Yeah.
On the podcast of champions.
Because it's supposed to be the best team ever for Todd Graham.
Yeah, and I think it's part and parcel of the disappointment of the Pac-12 South this year. You know, you've got ASU and Arizona are both, you know, scuffling right around 500. You've got, you know, UCLA being a little disappointing, USC being a little disappointing, and, you know, Utah probably playing a little bit above their heads. But the whole, you know, division kind of came back to the pack, and I think ASU was probably this is a good question. Who was the most disappointing team in the Pac-12 South this year?
Who? Well, I don't think you could say Colorado because.
No, I wouldn't say Colorado, but they were a disappointment, but they weren't the most disappointing.
I think I would have to go ASU because, you know, you didn't pick them to have a losing record for sure, but at least competing for the Pac-12 South title. And then to, you know, to be 6-7, 4-5 in conference, it just wasn't the right. It just didn't work this year.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mean, I didn't have super high expectations for USC. I thought they would be like a 9-ish win team. So they went, what, 1 under expectation? I thought UCLA would be better. I thought they would have a chance at 10-2. But, you know, 8-4, it's a 2-win. I think I had ASU as like a 9-3 type team. And so they went kind of 3 wins under expectation. And the real issue for me was they just didn't look good at really any point this year. You know, they'd never really got it going, whereas there were flashes from the other teams in the South where they, you know, finally started to fire on all cylinders. It just seemed like a kind of a scuffling season for ASU, and maybe, you know, with a new quarterback, you know, somebody who maybe better fits their system, they'll be able to kind of recapture a little bit, but definitely, definitely a disappointing year for the Sun Devils.
You know, they looked like they might have turned things around when they beat UCLA late in the season when Washington was playing well, was able to get a win against the Huskies. I mean, so there was some bright spots. You know, they beat Arizona in a shootout, but the consistency certainly wasn't there. It was this kind of roller coaster thing, but to finish 6-7, man, I just did not see that coming.
No. And that was kind of a fitting end to the season for the Pac-12.
6-4.
Lose by a point.
Yeah, 6-4 in the bowl games. Like, that's not. Yeah.
That's not good, especially when a bunch of those wins came against non-Power 5 opponents.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. That's not good. Not good.
Well, I guess we put a little bow on the Pac-12 football schedule. There's still one game left. Obviously, the championship between Alabama and Clemson. No Pac-12 team in that one. But we can start talking about some of these questions. We had that one holdover from last week, Dave, that you had a good idea that we should wait a week and talk about it. So we can do that if you'd like.
Yeah, let's jump into that.
Do you have that question there, like the specific one?
Yeah, hold on.
Sorry.
I'm pulling it up.
The general just being like the high point and low point or the worst and the best for
each
team.
This is from Alex in Pasadena. Hola, amigos. Now that both Southern Cal and UCLA seasons are over, I didn't even realize this last week, but he threw in the Southern Cal just to you know, stick it to the Trojans. What's your best and worst part of each's season? Also, thanks for being brutally honest with the listeners. Keep up the great work. So we were asked that about UCLA and USC, but we decided to extend it to all of the Pac-12 schools to get all of their feedback about this. And do you have our answers from the other publishers and whatnot?
I do. I have the answers. So let's do the South first, I guess. And then I don't have everybody. So I have, let's see, I have, yeah, we'll go through them. And the ones that we don't have, we'll just kind of, I think I have everyone from the South. So we'll do the South, and then the North, there's some holes we'll have to fill in ourselves.
All right. Sounds good.
We were just talking about Arizona State. I'll do them. This is Chris Cartman. He said the best was beating then number 7 UCLA on the road after losing to USC to open Pac-12 play. It makes sense. Probably a high point of the season. The worst, he said, losing to Washington State, a third straight loss in a 3-game period in which Arizona State had a lead at some point in the fourth quarter. That was true. They blew a whole bunch of fourth quarter leads there.
Yeah, that's I think that would probably do it. I mean, you don't want to do recency bias, but I think maybe it's not a worst moment, but kind of the encapsulation of the season was, you know, deciding not to go for two on that situation where they obviously should have, just kind of a coaching blunder. I think, you know, that kind of encapsulates the frustration of the ASU season.
That's a good point. I think he sent this in before.
Yeah.
Probably before the bowl game, but.
Yeah.
All right. Let's, our buddy Jason for Arizona, Jason Shear. He said the worst. So he's reversed the order. I wonder if it's glass full, half glass, half empty, or whatever. Which one you put
this
first?
This is like a psych test. This is great.
The worst, Jason said, was failing to score an offensive touchdown at Washington in one of the worst games under Rodriguez. Yeah, that was
100%. It was one of the worst moments of my watching Pac-12 games this season too.
Yeah, that was a
miserable game to watch.
And then the best was the overtime win at home against Utah when Jared Randall completed his only pass of the game, a touchdown, which I think was in overtime, right? That was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. It was really cool. He was, I think, 1 for 6 or something like that and had to take over for a new Solomon in overtime. That was great. Yeah, yeah. Completely agree, Jason.
Good job with that, Jason. Thanks for sending that in. We'll go to Utah. So this is Brian Swinney. He said the best, so he's starting with the best, waxing Oregon 62-20 at Autzen Stadium to move into the national title picture. Hard to argue with that. That was a pretty big one.
Very hard to argue.
Worst, failing to score a touchdown against UCLA at home, eliminating themselves from the Pac-12 South race.
I think you could pick any of a couple of their losses. I don't know that they had a really, really awful moment. I would say the worst moment wasn't a game. It was just Devontae Booker going down. And that was directly before the UCLA game, but I would say that was kind of the thing that derailed it for them.
Yeah, I mean, kind of getting waxed by SC when they were, you know, number 3 in the country, that probably wasn't great either.
Yeah, I think UCLA was maybe like 3rd on their list, but he covers them. He knows better than we do.
Lose the double overtime loss to Arizona. That wasn't pretty. All right. Well, yeah. There's a few to choose from there. But yeah, definitely going to Autzen Stadium and absolutely, you know, smacking around the Ducks. You know, historic numbers. Like no one's ever put up 62 points at Autzen Stadium. I mean, that was a big deal. Like that's hands down for me.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right. Adam.
Did you get one?
Oh, sorry.
Okay. No, I was wondering if I went from Adam.
Yeah, we did. He set the win. So he Adam Munster Tiger. He covers Colorado, and his is a little longer. And he starts with the worst ending of the Hawaii game. The officials took a lot of heat for failing to spot the ball in 12 seconds, but the Buffaloes should have never let themselves get in that position. Down 8 with the clock running out. Hawaii fired its head coach midway through the season, so Colorado had no business losing that game, and it put the Buffs behind the 8-ball after just one game.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. That's, I mean, we were harping on that, just the whole Pac-12. You know, you can't lose those early season out-of-conference games, especially when they're it's a terrible team. Like that Adam said, fired their coach midway through the season. Best moment was beating in-state rival Colorado State. The Buffs have only lost to the Rams in back-to-back seasons once in the last 66 years. They were able to avoid having that happen again with an overtime victory against Mike Bobo's squad in week 3. With his parents up from Mexico to watch the game, Diego Gonzalez missed a game-winning field goal attempt at the end of regulation, but he got redemption by making a 32-yarder in overtime.
So the worst and best moments both took place in, like, the first 2 weeks of the season for Colorado.
Yeah. I think I would have said the Pac-12 win against Oregon State for a bet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was an awful game, but, yeah, I completely agree. I think that's much more significant, but you know what? One of those wins for Colorado was definitely the best moment of the year.
I mean, rivalry games are big and stuff, but I mean, I just really feel like that was, but neither one of those teams were going to win another game in the conference, it looked like. So, although Colorado had some really close moments against, you know, SC and UCLA, they could have definitely won some more, but getting over that hump where they had lost 14 Pac-12 games in a row or whatever it was, I thought that was a big one.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right, should I do UCLA?
Sure.
And leave you for the last. Oh, worst moment. Oh, there were so many to choose from. I think I would go with UCLA losing to Stanford yet again, particularly given all the, you know, the – I think that one moment where Owusu caught that ball while getting pass interfered in the end zone, just the spectacular catch that will live on forever, was probably like the low point. Like that was the lowest point for UCLA this season. But you could also easily point to the loss to USC, the loss to Nebraska. I mean, it wasn't significant, but that was ugly. There were a lot of low moments to choose from, but I think I would have to go with Stanford. And then the high point, being cynical, I would say immediately before Virginia when there was a lot of hope. But I would say, you know, probably the Utah game, if we're looking at like in the midst of the season. They were playing pretty well from a defensive perspective at that point. They still had control of the Pac-12 South. If they beat USC, they would have gone to the title game. So I think that Utah game, but I think the point where the hope was the highest was probably like midway through the Virginia game when UCLA was still completely healthy and looking pretty good. But I would go Utah for the high point, and I would go low point Stanford.
Yeah, I think – I'm trying to think. The Arizona State game could have been a low point. I mean, that's, you know, I think UCLA was top 10 at the time, and Arizona State just got waxed by SC inexplicably, and then they come back and beat, you know, the Bruins in the Rose Bowl. That was was that in a contention? Was that in the running, Dave?
I'm looking at it from a more historical perspective. In terms of this season, yeah, I think it would have been in contention. I think the reason I picked Stanford is because that's now the fifth loss to Stanford for Jim Mora. And it again, wasn't a particularly close game. It wasn't in any way in doubt. And I think I would still pick USC over the ASU game just because I think this was, you know, it was another one of these momentum shifts. I think if UCLA had won this one, puts a little bit more, well, I don't know. You could argue it so many different ways, but if they still give the job to Clay Helton, then you've got Clay Helton starting his career at 4-5 at this point. And that probably doesn't give him a ton of momentum, but there's a lot of circumstances to look into. I would put ASU probably third in that list.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. That catch though in the Stanford game, one of those. It's just you don't want to get posterized, and that was kind of one of those moments.
That was awesome. Yeah. It's just too awesome. Give me USC.
So for USC, there's a couple different ways you could go. I mean, worst, there's so many. I mean, there's a whole lot to go through. It's hard to kind of argue. Well, I'll do best. I think the best has to be beating UCLA, losing to Jim Mora 3 years in a row. It was a really big deal. They needed to get a win there. They needed some kind of momentum. And if you look over the last four games, that was the only game they won. But it really kind of got the fan base back again. And it allowed Clay Helton to get the job. Really, if they don't win that game, even though Pat Hayden said, it didn't matter what happened in that game, but they named him the permanent head coach right after that. So I think it really had a lot to do with it.
Ryan, does that also make it the worst moment?
That is a very good point. If you want to be, you got the sunshine pumpers and you got the doom and gloomers usually on the message boards. The doom and gloomers would say it's also the worst moment because if you lose to UCLA, you don't have Clay Helton as the head coach. You can't hire him then. You couldn't hire him after getting smacked around in the – well, they wouldn't have been in the Stanford – wouldn't have been in the Pac-12 championship game. So they would say that. But I would say the worst game I think you'd have to go with Washington because they lost to, Washington that didn't – that wasn't when Washington's offense was good. The defense was certainly good. It's been good all year, but the offense didn't really get clicking until the second half of the year. To lose them 17-12 and that kind of spiraling into Steve Sarkisian getting fired. I mean, I think firing your head coach probably has to be the worst moment, I would guess. But it all kind of started with the Washington game. So game wise, I'd probably go with Washington. But, as far as like the moment, it had to be like that 24-hour period when Sark didn't show up for practice. And gets, indefinitely leave of absence and then obviously getting fired right after that.
Yeah, that probably didn't. I would completely agree with that one.
There's a lot, though. Yeah. There's plenty you could argue for.
Yeah, we should actually just have a separate award ceremonies for the worst moment of the year for UCLA and USC. Because I think if you start at the beginning of the year, it's...
There's a lot.
Pretty much a long list of just bad things. Yeah. I think USC obviously gets the overall, but I think UCLA's got some nice moments where if you pick specific categories, I think UCLA could clean up. It's like one of those, if we're talking award season, it's like a technically well-made film that'll clean up in a lot of awards. Obviously, USC wins best picture, best screenplay, the whole thing. But I think UCLA gets best cinematography, definitely.
For drama in a season, yes, there's no question. Those two schools, the ones we just happened to cover, had more than their fair share than anybody. Well, let's do Pac-12 North. So we have three teams. So we'll do I'll do the Washington schools first. So Chris Fetter is from Washington. He starts off with the best. Watching the number one defense in the Pac-12 thrive after losing four top 45 players to the NFL draft.
Yeah. I mean, if we're going broad spectrum, yeah. I think Washington – just having that defense all year was pretty impressive. For them, I would say the biggest win was probably the USC win at USC.
Yeah.
But that
was true because everyone thought the defense was going to take a big step back and they played better. Those young guys played in their system as opposed to maybe more talented guys kind of doing their own thing. It was like a system that they had that worked well. So.
Absolutely.
The worst, watching more losses to Oregon and Arizona State. That makes 12 straight against Oregon and 10 straight against Arizona State. Wow, I didn't even realize that. So double-digit losing streaks to two Pac-12 opponents for Washington. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to pick a worst moment of this season for Washington because I think, just a message to Washington fans, I think you've got to be happy with where you are and with the trajectory of the program right now under Chris Peterson. To go 7-6 this year, in a year where nobody was expecting anything out of that team, with the kind of hope you have on offense, what you've got on defense, a very young defense. I think it was the youngest team in the Pac-12 from a starter perspective this year. There's so much to be hopeful about that. Yeah, they lost to Oregon again, and it wasn't great, but I mean, I think they're going to be much more competitive next year and the year after that. And I think they're going to be competing for the Pac-12 North before too long.
I think you could argue the worst moment was when David Woods preseason picked the Washington to only win three games. That could have
been. No, no. So, So we should do the best and worst moments for us this year, because I think that was definitely one of my worst picks. But what did you have Stanford doing this year?
I had them
like 7-5,
dropping way off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not quite. 12 games, not pretty quite. Good.
Yeah, 12 wins, not bad.
Yeah. So our buddy Greg up at Washington State, he said the best moment was tying Oregon on the road with 1 second left in regulation time, and then winning it in double overtime.
Yeah, completely agree. No argument there.
That was a big one. And then, yeah, it's been another big, you know, if you win in Autzen Stadium, that's pretty good. That's usually going to be one of your better moments. Worst, face planting at home in the season opener to FCS team Portland State.
Yeah, and it's what derailed, you know, that whole early part of the season for Washington State and made it, you know, where they were kind of flying under the radar as a semi-good team until, what, the eighth or ninth game of the year because of that loss. Would have changed the complexion a little bit of the season for them. I still don't think they would have, you know, been in contention for much, you know, other bowl given how they performed in Pac-12 play. But, you know, that's just another one of those losses where you just kind of scratch your head. But hopefully those are behind them now and they're, you know, ready to go. I would put an honorable mention for worst any time the special teams were on the field in the first, like, seven games of the year.
Yeah, that's true. That was so bad. But that one loss, too, though, I think it hurt the whole conference. Washington State could have had game day. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that without – you win that game, and it's a different narrative. You basically, as soon as Washington State lost that game, no one's even thinking about them again. Then they start winning a bunch of games at the end of the season. They play Stanford tough. And you're rethinking, like, well, this Washington State team's pretty good, but they weren't going to get the benefit of the doubt through the first three quarters of the season because of that loss. So I think it brought them down, as a national, perception and the whole conference, really, especially when they start beating other teams. It doesn't make the Pac-12 look all that good that the team that lost to Portland State is beating other teams like Oregon, you know?
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. All right, so who's up next?
We got this is the last one, then we're going to have to make up the last three. So Angie at Oregon State, the worst was losing to Colorado 17-13 at home.
Yeah, I would kind of give honorable mention to the entire season, but sure, okay.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, that was a chance, though, and it was a close game. You know, to win a Pac-12 game, that was it. So I would hitch my wagon to that one. Okay.
I would say actually the worst moment was losing Kalani Sitake to BYU.
That's a good point too. All right.
But okay, go to the best.
The best. Second half of the Civil War, where the Beavers scored 35 points, outscoring the Ducks 35-21 in the half, and gave the team and fans hope for the future of the program.
That is so sad and so depressing. The second half of a losing effort. I can't disagree. I think that was probably the, you know, gives you the most hope heading into next year for an Oregon State fan. And you probably wouldn't have picked. So who did they beat this year? It was what, Weber State and who else? Nicholls State?
They beat Weber State 26-7, and then they beat San Jose State 35-21.
Right. Yeah, I don't think you can pick either of those. Yeah, I would say the best performance they had against a pretty good team was that second half against Oregon. So, yeah, I have no disagreement there.
Didn't they go up 7-0 on Michigan or something? Like, could that be the best moment? Or
The first half against Michigan wasn't bad.
Yeah.
But then it just kind of, you know, Gary Anderson went super conservative, decided to kick a couple of field goals or punt or something when he probably should have gone for it on a few short fourth downs, and that just, you know, kind of derailed them against a disciplined Harbaugh team.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with her with the Oregon State, you know, Oregon second half, because I remember picking that game. I don't know if we both did, but I definitely had, because the week before I picked them to get shut out by Washington, and they scored like a late touchdown. That would be my worst moment. They scored that late touchdown. I didn't get my shutout pick exactly right. But it looked like, okay, Oregon's going to pound them, and we picked them, you know, Oregon minus whatever, like 25 points or something. And then Oregon State comes back, and Oregon just goes into their shell. So that annoyed me the most after picking the other side. So I'll give her to her. Yeah, that'll be the best. That should be the best moment.
I believe the line on that game was actually minus 35.
35, okay.
If I remember correctly, yeah. Yeah.
So it looked, it was definitely feasible when Oregon was up 35-0 or whatever it was, and then.
Yep.
Speaking of Oregon, so we didn't hear from our buddy Steve. What would you think the worst moment is for Oregon?
Worst game was losing by 42 points at home to Utah. Worst moment was any point where Vernon Adams got hurt this year, the finger against Michigan State, or the, you know, the injury in the Alamo Bowl that directly led to that loss. So those are my worst moments for Oregon. What are your worst moments?
Yeah, that 61-28. That's when they beat Georgia State. The 45-38 double overtime loss to Washington State was crappy, but really the 62-20 beatdown from Utah that really elevated Utah to get into the top five and stuff. That was pretty bad, but maybe it's the recent thing, but having a 31-0 halftime lead and blowing that against TCU, I think I got to go with that as being the worst. I mean, that was just absolutely awful that they couldn't score in the second half and lose to TCU in triple overtime.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely one of those two games. And then the best moment, I think, pretty clear favorite for me, Oregon beating Stanford. This, you know, kind of came when Vernon Adams was getting back, and it kind of showed that Oregon still has it to contend with, at that time, a playoff contending Stanford team. I thought that was pretty clearly their top moment this year.
Yeah, I mean, to finish with a six-game winning streak, and really that was the crown jewel of it, is beating Stanford. 38-28 on the road. I mean, 38-36 on the road. They beat USC at home. They beat Oregon State, and they kind of let them back into the second half. But that was the big one. So I think, the whole six-game winning streak I thought was great. You know, Vernon Adams playing well. But I'd have to give it to that one moment beating Stanford on the road.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, as crappy a year as Oregon, you know, in theory had, you know, four losses, and they haven't had four losses in a long time, they were, what, a three-point game against Michigan State, an overtime loss to Washington State from kind of being in it, you know, like being in the conversation for the playoffs still, which is pretty incredible. In a year where their quarterback was down, they were, you know, an overtime loss and 3 points away from, you know, actually still being very much in contention for that. So kudos to Oregon for even getting through that year with Vernon Adams being as kind of hurt as he was. But yeah, I think that Stanford game was definitely their best moment.
All right, let's do Cal. You got a worst moment for Cal?
Ooh, their loss to UCLA wasn't good. And that kind of came at, you know, a moment where they were trying to get out of, they just lost to Utah and they were riding kind of high. They still had a pretty good amount of momentum. They were just a one-loss team at that point. And then UCLA beat them by 16. It wasn't really that close of a game. And then they started off on that was part of a four-game losing streak. So I don't know. I think I would pick the UCLA game, but you could make an argument for the Oregon game. But definitely one of those four losses in that stretch that kind of killed all their momentum this year.
I was going to pick the UCLA game too, but for the main reason being that up until that point, they were 5-1. They had a bye week. So they had time to prepare. They lose to UCLA. They're 5-2.
No more 11-1.
The 11-1 dream is dead.
Yeah, I think that might have been my worst moment of the year, honestly. When the 11-1 dream died, I think a part of me died with it.
Yeah. And then the best. What do you think?
Best moment. I thought the win against Texas, just in terms of just the optics of it. Obviously, Texas wasn't very good this year. But winning that road game against Texas at the beginning of the year, I think that kind of put the stamp on Cal as, hey, we're pretty decent this year. We're not bad. And I think that was kind of a good moment for the program, a good moment for that team. And You know, in retrospect, that Cal Washington game was pretty impressive, going on the road and beating Washington. But I think, yeah, I think I'd give it to, I think I'd give it to Cal beating Texas on the road.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, any, there's three wins that they had of, you know, the five game winning streak, you know, beating Texas on the road, beating Washington on the road, and then beating Washington State. I mean, I you know, those are. You saw the way Washington and Washington State were playing at the end of the season. I mean, those, I think you look back and those are good wins for Cal. So I think I would go somewhere kind of in that, you know, sort of range. You know, beating Oregon State's not that big of a deal. You know, the Arizona State game, but you know, the Armed Forces Bowl, that's something too.
But, oh yeah, sure.
But those three wins, the last three wins of their five game losing streak, I thought that was really, you know, important that they, looking back on them, those are not bad wins at all. They're good wins.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And then, so Stanford. Is there any argument about their worst moment? I mean, that Northwestern game, I don't think I've had more fun tweeting during a game or reading Ryan, your Twitter during a game. But that was just the quintessential early season weird David Shaw game where just it seems like he, you know, the whole team hasn't quite woken up. His play calling is stuck in some different century and just it's awful. And they lost that game by 10 to a Northwestern team that turned out to be pretty good, but not by any means a team that should have been able to hold Stanford to 6.
Yeah. By far the worst moment. I mean, with something we talked about, it kept them out of the playoffs. I mean, there's so many. And it's, you know, it's a pretty good Northwestern team, but, you know, Iowa handled Northwestern, and obviously at the end of the season, Stanford just boat raced Iowa. So it's, you know, Stanford was a better team than Northwestern. I think even watching the game, you knew they were a better team. And maybe the 9 a.m. start and all that kind of stuff, maybe it all played in the factor, but no question about it, the worst moment, maybe for the whole Pac-12, was Stanford losing to Northwestern.
Absolutely. And then, my best moment for Stanford was this most recent one, winning the Rose Bowl, and not just winning, but just suffocating Iowa. You know, just it wasn't even a real contest. You could make an argument for Stanford Notre Dame, but I thought this one, in terms of putting a final stamp on the season, you know, everyone was talking about Stanford the day after that game. Just wow, they're really impressive. Christian McCaffrey, he should have won the Heisman. Stanford, nobody wants to play them right now. I think that's great for recruiting. I think it's great for the life of that program, for the lifeblood of that program. I think it gives a lot of juice to David Shaw. And then, you know, he follows that up with, you know, emphatically denying that he's even thinking about the NFL. He wants to stay at Stanford. I think a lot of Pac-12 fans are probably envious of Stanford's program right now because they are so consistent year in and year out. They've got probably the most stable framework. And I think that game kind of typified that.
I would agree, and you know, you could argue as far as the whole Christian McCaffrey thing because he didn't. They Stanford beat Notre Dame, which was a big deal. He didn't have the greatest game in that one. He wasn't a standout in that game where he was in the Pac-12 championship game and of course the Rose Bowl. But the fact that he went absolutely bonkers against USC and you know ran a touchdown in, threw a touchdown and caught a touchdown. And the same thing, Kevin Hogan did the exact same thing. And he had, you know, set all the records for how many hundreds of yards of total offense and all of that, scored all those touchdowns. I think that really allowed him to be in the position he was to at least make a run at the Heisman and finish second to Malik Henry. So that USC game probably got him over the top. And then if there was another vote after the Rose Bowl, he would have got there. But I think the USC game at least put him, you know, in the national, you know, conversation as far as the Heisman goes.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think you can make that argument too. I think any of those final three games are a fair argument to make, and I think it was all part of just Stanford. I mean, they just put their stamp on this season, and I think they were one Northwestern win away from. I think they would have been playing in the title game. I think they're right there. I think they would have been. It would have been a ton of fun to watch them against Bama. That offensive line versus that defensive line would have been so much fun to watch.
Yeah.
But all right. What can you do?
That was a great question, though, and I'm glad we got the input from the other Scout publishers. That was good.
Yeah, that was great. So we get to the final questions in the inbox?
Yes.
All right, this is from Bob. Note on Pac-12 bowl record. Note, after the 2009 season, the then Pac-10 bowl record was 2-7. Only winners were USC and UCLA. This year, those schools may have the exact opposite distinction. I thought this was interesting, especially if it plays out the way today with U of O and ASU. Unfortunately, it did not, but that is an interesting note.
Yeah, back in the day, it was kind of the opposite. I think it's a more balanced conference now. We're seeing so much more power shift to the north. I mean, the teams that are on the rise are in the north right now. So I think the way we talked about how deep the south was last year, probably this year we're going to be talking about, hey, Washington State could come up and win, you know, and Washington can come up and win. And so I think there's a lot to be talked, you know, it's spread around. The wealth is spread around a lot more in the conference now than it was back then.
Yeah, and I would also say any year where the LA schools are in, you know, a tier bowl game is probably a good year for them to be predicted for losses because generally they're not going to play well. You know, I think UCLA is not going to, you know, UCLA doesn't get it up for anything over, like, say, a Sun Bowl, and USC doesn't get up for anything over, say, you know, what would it be, Alamo Bowl? Alamo Bowl or better, they'll get up for it.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I would say.
So, yeah. Justin has his take on the worst of the year. I'll run through them pretty quickly. Truth be told, this is hard to point to one thing, as many schools have so many things to point to. For Arizona, he says the UCLA game, which we didn't get from anyone, but that was a game where Arizona, I think, lost to New Solomon early on. Gerard Randall came in, played pretty poorly, and UCLA kind of blew him out, so that's probably fair. Yeah. Arizona State, he says, not going for two up by five against West Virginia, which,
fair.
Right, fair.
Completely fair. Cal,
he says, the UCLA game, which I think we were in agreement was probably the low point for them. Mostly because it, you know, took away the 11-1 possibilities. Colorado, he says the Hawaii game. Oregon, he says the second half of the Alamo Bowl, which I think we both agree because yeah. is definitely in contention. Oregon State, he agrees with my take, the 2015 season. Stanford, he says the Northwestern game. UCLA, giving up the TD to Stanford while pass interfering to prevent a TD. Wow. Okay. Justin and I are, like, right in line with each other.
Yeah.
USC says, too much material to work with here. I'll defer to Ryan as to what one thing to point to in that dumpster fire of a year. Some nominees would be the last play of the Wisconsin game, both Stanford games, the Washington game, Sark, salute to Troy, Pat Hayden, Justin Wilcox, or Bob Connolly.
Yeah, all fair points. You could argue any of those. But, the last play against Washington where you had to throw a Hail Mary – and you throw a 7-yard out on 4th and 10 with 7 seconds left. That's a pretty low point. So I mean,
that was quintessential. It was quintessential. Utah, he said, thinking Cameron Smith was one of your receivers, probably fair and a little sad. Washington, honestly, they so greatly exceeded my expectations. I can't really think of anything fair.
You guys like then, must have talked before this or something.
Yeah, you know, we're tight. Me and Justin. Washington State, he says, the Portland State game.
Yeah.
And he says, as an SC fan, it's hard to think of good things related to the season. I would definitely say schools like Washington, Stanford, Utah, and Washington State have much to celebrate. SC can hang its hat in the fact that it's somehow found its way into the championship game. Not really sure about the rest. All right, good stuff from Justin.
Yeah.
Our man Nick has his recap.
Oh, Nick, all right.
Hi, this is Nick from Cyprus. Well, my 7-win prediction for Pac-12 doesn't come true, but the Pac-12 could have swept as well, so here goes my quick recap. First, the granddaddy of them all, Rose Bowl, Stanford 45 versus Iowa 16. Well, it was the Christian McCaffrey show, broke Rose Bowl and Stanford season records, dominant performance. Next two games, big letdowns. First game is Oregon 41 versus TCU 47, 3 OTs. So Oregon was up 31-0 at halftime to lose by 6. Like I said before the season, Oregon is soft. Yes, they score, but no D. Huge letdown, the biggest letdown by far. Oregon will never win a title the way they play. Garbage. Wow.
I don't agree with Nick on that. I think they could win a title, but go ahead.
I feel the heat from that take right there. I feel the heat. Next, West Virginia 43 versus 42 ASU. Well, this went back and forth where West Virginia did enough to win. ASU best team that the ASU coach has said is funny. So questions. What are your final thoughts on bowl season? Ryan, what are your final thoughts on bowl season?
I mean, it was disappointing that Pac-12 was favored in all but, I think, one game or something. And, you know, it kind of fluctuated. But USC and UCLA should not have lost their games. Oregon should not have lost. Arizona State should not have lost. I really feel that the Pac-12 could have been, you know, 10-0 or 9-1. I mean, that was realistic. Once you got, like, Washington State beating Miami was a big deal. That could have been a moment, too. I mean, in the snow and everything, that could have been a good one. But that was one where you're like, yeah, I could see the Pac-12 losing that one. But the other ones, it just, they shouldn't have lost those games, you know? So, to me, it was disappointing. It was a very, you know, very SEC narrative thing where they go, 8-2 or whatever they did, and they got a chance to win the national title. It just was one of those things that the Pac-12 just didn't quite do enough early in the season and then late in the season, and it just they just left money on the table in my estimation, Dave.
They could have been a contender.
Yeah.
Instead of a bum, which is what he is. I agree. I think it was kind of a disappointing end to what was a pretty disappointing season for Pac-12. What are your thoughts on players leaving early for the NFL from all the Pac-12 teams? For the most part, I think it's been pretty fair. I think most of the guys I thought were going to leave, actually, outside of UCLA, I thought most of the guys who I thought were going to leave were going to leave. UCLA has just been a roller coaster. Day in and day out, I have no idea who's going to leave and who's going to stay. I thought Connor McDermott, the starting left tackle, was a sure thing to leave. He's coming back. I thought Caleb Benenock was probably going to come back. He's decided to leave. I thought Paul Perkins might come back. He's decided to leave. So there's no telling with UCLA, but I think everyone else, I haven't seen anyone that it was like, oh, wow, that's a huge shock. I think everyone else has been pretty fair.
Yeah, I think so. Usually it's SC has some really weird ones, and this year it's been kind of one thing that's been kind of boring. It's just Stua Craven's going to leave. Zach Banner said he's going to stay. We haven't heard of anyone else that's even thinking about it. I guess there could be a last-minute change of heart by like a Justin Davis or something, the running back. But, you know, for the most part, it's been pretty quiet on the SC front. Like, I agree with Dave. The ones that you hear around the conference, yeah, they kind of made sense. So,
yeah.
Nothing
too crazy. And then Nick asks a question that maybe we'll dive into in our next podcast. News on recruiting regarding Pac-12 and both high school all-star games, the Under Armour and the Jarhead one. LOL, Army joke.
So he's an Army guy. Thanks for your service, Nick, by the way. But yeah, he was talking about the Marine Bowl, the Semper Fi Bowl, you know, where the Marines run that one.
Yeah.
I'm actually, so I think we covered this at the top. I'm actually in San Antonio right now for the Army Bowl practices. So that game will be on Saturday. But maybe we'll have like Huffman or Biggins or both those guys on and kind of talk about Pac-12 recruiting in general.
That would be a lot of fun. So we'll do that maybe next week.
Okay.
And then he has this really funny joke at the end. Last basketball news. A really funny joke.
I know USC basketball was up like 22 points on Washington on the road and blew it and lost.
Well, UCLA just got swept on the road by Washington, which virtually guarantees I will not be talking about basketball on this podcast this year. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right. This is from Buff Daddy. Kudos, comment, question, and worst best of Washington State season. This is Rich Ski from Olympia, Washington. Love your show. Great job. Keep it up. Looking forward to more. Comment, wow, after your extensive expert analysis, I never expected the Pac-12 to be so crappy in the bowl games. It was a nasty finish as a conference. It pains me to say that the SC did better this year. SEC did better this year.
Oh.
Question, seems to be some thought that Luke Falk holds the ball too long. I'd love to see if using your vast resources, you may be able to provide some definitive evidence to support or refute this contention.
I would say, yeah. I mean, if he held on, if he got rid of the ball a little quicker, he might throw for 600 yards instead of 500. But it's hard to, I mean, what do you want the guy to do? Like, he's doing so much. That seems like nitpicky to me, Dave.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, I think in that offense, it's so much, you know, timing and quick passes that maybe he could get a little bit quicker. But I think he's running it pretty efficiently right now. I wouldn't have too many complaints with how he's running that offense, especially when it was humming the way it was throughout most of the year. I think he was maybe out of a little bit out of rhythm in the bowl game.
yeah.
might have affected him. You know, he did sit out some time at the end of the year. But I have no concerns about Luke Falk leading that offense next year.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was snowing and stuff. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to fault the guy for not. I don't think they scored in the second half of that game, but yeah, I mean, the guys was balling all year, so it's you know, they would have like, you know, 517 yards of offense, and those 17 yards were running, and the 500 were passing. So
exactly,
yeah, hard to fault them there.
And then worst part of Washington State season, losing Falk, the Apple Cup. Yeah, completely yes. fair. And then best part of Washington State season, he says every UW loss. So this might be one of those fans who's more of a rival team hater than an actual, you know, team rooter.
Right.
Or what it is.
That is kind of funny, though. Every time. I mean, there's a lot of good moments for Washington State. And if you're still going to pick Washington losing, which they, you know, they had their share of losses this year, but not as many as we thought they were going to have.
Yeah. All right. Bernie from Oxnard has a question.
Okay.
Coaching speculation. Hi, Dave. Reading the Bro Forum, I can't understand the venom and negativity directed towards Coach Mora. As a longtime UCLA fan since the 1950s, and especially considering the 10 years prior to Coach Mora's hire, I remember the six-win seasons, UCLA's inability to get any interest from the four- and five-star recruits, and just a feeling of malaise over the program. Coach Mora changed all that. He made us relevant again, and top recruits now look at UCLA as a viable option. This leads me to my question regarding the speculation surrounding Coach Mora staying at UCLA. Isn't the fact that the recruits interested in UCLA are all saying that he has told them he is not leaving UCLA proof enough that he is staying? I mean, he would never misinform the kids he is recruiting. Isn't this confirmation of his intent? Thanks, Dave. Bernie. All right. Well, first of all, there was a little bit of hubbub over the last week that Jim Mora was, you know, looking a little bit more seriously at the NFL, which is what Bernie's referring to here. This is just me speaking generally and not about any coach in particular. You can't trust anything a coach says to a recruit. The recruits shouldn't entirely trust it. They should take everything a coach says to them ever, 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 ever with a grain of salt, because the coaches have a vested interest in getting you into school. So generally when we're reporting things, and I'm speaking for Ryan here and he can chime in, but when we're reporting things, we're taking what the recruits are telling us about what the coach has told them with an even bigger grain of salt, because now it's going through a second person. So no, that's not definitive proof for us. I mean, that's not ever going to be definitive proof of really anything for us.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, that's, and you can go back and play the tape of Nick Saban saying, "No, I'm not taking the Alabama job." And of course he took the Alabama job. I mean, they're going to say what they need to say at the time. You're not that they're liars or cheating or anything like that. It's just, that's, you know, kind of the way the game is played. So I wouldn't say just because a recruit, and you could talk to a recruit and he could tell you, "Hey, the coach told me this," and the coach didn't even tell him that. So, I mean, there's so much, it's hard to, you know, we can report what the kid says, but they don't always tell us the truth either. So yeah, there's stuff like that, but I don't think, yeah, there's venom on all the message boards. We see it on the Peristyle where there's turmoil and all kind of stuff going on and people get really passionate. But I do think that Jim Moore's done, like he said, I mean, he's done so many good things for the program. And I think just kind of building some of those foundation blocks that however long he's there and whoever the next coach is has better, you know, better facilities, better, there's a better infrastructure because of Jim Mora. So I think you can be a little patient sometimes if you lose a game that you don't think you should lose or you didn't get to this level yet. I think he's done so much good for the program, you know, to be nitpicky about some of the stuff. He didn't get the high enough yet. He's got the program, I think, rolling in the right direction. So I think, you know, UCLA fans should, you know, give him a shot there.
Yeah, I for the most part, I agree. I think if you're judging it off of wins and losses, I think, you know, going 8-4 one year, I mean, that's not a big deal. I mean, that's going to happen. You're going to have years where you get hit by injuries or something happens where it's a down year. I think what's probably bothering people more is just the, you know, the NFL rumors year after year after year. I think people are probably getting a little fatigued by it. And I think that coming on the heels of the 8-4 year is probably rubbing people wrong way. So that's probably more what it is than just the 8-4, you know, losing four games in and of itself, or 8-5, whatever it ended up being. I think it's more, you know, kind of the NFL stuff than anything. But Yeah, I think there's probably as with anything on a message board, it gets a little overboard. Goes a little bit it goes all the way up to an 11, and we just want it down by like right around a 5 or 6 on the dial.
Yeah,
and it's goes a little out of control.
It's a challenge this time of year when teams don't meet expectations. We're moderating the boards. You end up having to ban people and all this kind of stuff that's not very fun. You know, you don't want that to happen, but just it's kind of the nature of the business, I guess.
All right, this is from Danny Y from Fountain Valley. David and Ryan, love the show. Been listening since day one. Keep doing the great job that you are doing. Makes my daily 2-hour commute bearable. Question is, what are the agents telling the NFL prospects to get them to quit school and sign early with them? The agents are uniformly, well, I wouldn't say uniformly, but most of them are lying to these kids. or they don't know. Or they just aren't very well informed, and they're telling these kids they're going to be much better prospects than they are. They're offering them, you know, money or very, you know, very low interest loans to, you know, get started on all this stuff. And it's generally a racket. And, you know, a lot of these kids get sucked in by it. Especially, I think it's something that happens especially to kids in the LA area because they're so close to so many agents. And so many agents are around the UCLA and USC programs at all times, just in terms of alumni and various other people, that it's something that I think is not unique to these two schools, but definitely I think more prevalent than at other schools. So you'll have, I think, more marginal decisions at both schools than you will at other places because they have so much noise in their ears at all times. Have you kind of seen that at USC?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you see a lot of people make bad decisions. We saw George Farmer come out last year. He had like 30 career catches and he leaves and he's going to, you know, go to the NFL, and obviously, you know, it didn't work out all that well for him. But I think agents are in these guys' ears. I mean, it's in their best interest. It's like, you know, if you meet a real estate agent, he wants to sell your house, you know, and you're an agent, you know, a sports agent wants to handle your contract and take a chance. So he's not worried that it might be better for you to stay one more year. I think a good agent would be like, hey, you know, I think it'd be good. I'd rather you stay, and I'd love to handle you next year, and I know there'll be a lot of people in your ear on the way, but I think what's best for you is to stick around in school. I mean, I don't think you hear a lot about that, you know, happening all that much. So it's weird. If you counted up, if you, like, if somehow you were fly on the wall for every agent conversation around and counted up the number of times – number of players that agents said, I think you're going to go in X round of the NFL draft. You probably get like 60 people being told they're going to be a first round draft pick. And there's only, you know, 32 picks or whatever. So I think there's a lot of, I mean, it might not be blatant lying, but maybe they're being overly optimistic. And, but it, you know, people want to make this, that's your dream, is to make it to the NFL. And if someone's telling you, hey, I think you can do it, you're probably apt to listen to them.
Yeah, I that's definitely a big part of it. And he asked about some specifics regarding UCLA guys. And so it's, can you speculate what kinds of things they would offer a bubble prospect like Alex Redmond versus a slam dunk prospect like Miles Jack? Is it all money? Is there some kind of training program? What else am I not thinking of? I would say it's mostly money, for a lot of these kids. You know, and everyone's got a different circumstance where they, you know, need something, or they, you know, need to get out quicker, or, and some of them are, you know, maybe not entirely football related. Some of them are, you know, decisions that they're having to make based off of their family situation or what's going on with them. So you'll see them, you know, not making, like, when you're a fan and you're judging a decision, you're like, well, you're not good enough to go in a top round, so you should go back to school. But it's not always that simple of a binary, you know, kind of decision. There's a lot of other factors at play. And in general, I would say it's probably a little, naive to think that these agent conversations just suddenly crop up in December of these guys' junior years. For the most part, I would say they're being contacted sometime after their freshman season, if they played, to, you know, gauge interest and that sort of thing. I would be stunned if these conversations aren't ongoing from a pretty early on point in most kids' careers, if they're, you know, even a marginal NFL prospect.
Yeah, I think there's, you could tailor it for each kid where you like Miles Jack or Sua Cravens or DeForest Buckner, whoever, you know, whoever you're talking about, like those are guys who are like tons of production in college. It's easy to project them to be a high pick. It, that just kind of makes sense. And then there's other guys that have like kind of potential where like USC's tackle Zach Banner was going to come out. He was all Pac-12 first team, but, you know, I didn't really heard a lot of buzz about him in the draft. But because he's so big, he's like 6'9", 350 pounds or whatever, like, he could be more on potential as opposed to film and stuff like that. Like, so you can have guys that are maybe really fast or whatever that the agents can say, hey, you know, here's why they, you know, NFL, they're not drafting like the steady, never makes a mistake guy. They want the guy that can break through and has a lot of upside. So if you're really fast or really big or whatever, then there's potential there. And I think that's another way that, you know, if you don't have the same kind of production that a Miles Jack or someone has, you can be sold on the potential and what you could, you know, potentially be in the NFL.
Yeah, I think that's well said. That's well said. We've got no more questions, Ryan.
All right. Well, that's good. Cause,
I think we're done.
I think, yeah. So this was, hopefully this sounded okay to you guys. We apologize. We're recording this a little different setup since I'm recording it in my hotel room, and we got Dave like on an iPad somewhere off in who knows where. So a little different setup.
A little different.
Yeah.
I'm sitting actually in a closet so my daughter will not harass me while I'm recording this. But it's a nice walk-in closet, so that's all that matters.
Come right? out of the closet, Dave.
I will. Someday.
All right. Well, hey, great stuff. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. We'll definitely get into recruiting, I think, on the next show. So we'll try to line up Biggins or Huffman or whoever. And so if you have any questions about your team recruiting-wise, definitely send them in, pac12podcast@gmail.com. And we'll do our best to cover all the different teams, recruiting and all that kind of stuff, what's going on there. All right. Sound good, Dave?
Good stuff.
Sweet.
Sounds great.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you. And everyone else, thanks so much for tuning in to the podcast.